So we are in Revelation 15, and we're getting to the pointy end of things in the book of Revelation. We've covered the seven letters to the seven churches, and then we've seen the seven seals on the scroll opened. There's been seven trumpets that have sounded, now we're up to the point where the seven bowls or chalices or vials are about to be poured out. And the thing that we've been taking an approach to the book of Revelation, which is commonly called the preterist perspective, and that is that the view that the book of Revelation is a prophecy regarding the destruction of Jerusalem. And the reason that's important, we read in Hebrews, is that while the temple still stands in Jerusalem, that we don't have full access to the temple in heaven, because there's still this stumbling block in the way. So for early Christians, do they worship in the temple under the old covenant system, or do they, you know? And this was a tension throughout the epistles we're constantly reading about what's the right thing to do and so on. And it says in Hebrews that until the physical temple is cleared away, then we don't have full access to the throne of God in heaven, in the sense of that being the true temple, that there's no stumbling block to stop us from entering in fully. And we, have taken the approach that, so there's a couple of things going on there. One is the full establishment of the new covenant is what the book of Revelation is primarily about. But as part of the establishment of the new covenant means the removing of the old. And in order to close up the old covenant, there needs to be a fulfillment of the old covenant, which not only included blessings for fealty to the covenant, but also cursing and punishment to the unfaithful under the covenant. And so in order to wind up the covenant, the punishments have to be meted out. And the underlying, theme to the punishment that's being meted out is that Jerusalem is the city that is known throughout history, and Jesus and the prophets refer to it as the city that stoned the prophets and killed the Lord's Messiah, who was the ultimate prophet and the one about whom all prophecy was written. And so as a result of that, the punishment of God is going to be poured out on the city of Jerusalem, and we know historically that the city was destroyed in 70 AD under the Emperor Vespasian. So we've been moving through that. There's a whole heap of stuff that's in the background. If you haven't caught up with it, it's online on our website. You can go back and listen through the previous chapters. But we've come to this point where in Revelation 15, we have another sign in the heavens. Verse 1 of Revelation 15 says, I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues. Last, because with them God's wrath is completed. And I saw what looked like a sea of glass glowing with fire, and standing beside the sea, those who had been victorious over the beast and its image and over the number of its name. They held harps given them by God and sang the song of God's servant Moses and of the Lamb. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the nations. Who will not fear you, Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. So, along with the great signs that John's already seen in his vision, the one of the woman clothed in the sun with the moon at her feet, representing the church, and also the vision of the dragon, representing Satan, John sees a third great and marvelous sign with seven angels that bring the seven last plagues. And it's made clear there that these plagues are not last because it's the end of history, but rather last because it's with them that God's wrath will be finally spent on the covenant breakers in the destruction of the city. So we've got these really interesting images. We've got a sea of glass mixed with fire. And that brings to mind several pictures. You know how I said the book of Revelation, it's like a mosaic. We've got all these, while we see a big picture, it's actually made up of lots of little pictures that if we go in close, we can see the little pictures, but when we come back, we see the big picture of things. And so when we've got this sea of glass, there's a fair bit happening. First of all, the pavement before the Lord on Mount Sinai at the giving of the first covenant is represented similar to this sea of glass. So we read in Exodus 24 and verse 9, Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. And under his feet was something like a pavement made of lapis lazuli, as bright and blue as the sky. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God and ate and drank. And so there's these hints behind this picture of the sea of glass in terms of the new covenant being presented, just as the old covenant was presented. We also see in Ezekiel that there was a vault when Ezekiel had his vision of God, and the vault was sort of like this sea of glass. In Ezekiel 1, verse 25, it says, "Then there came a voice from above the vault over their heads," talking about the creatures in his image, in the vision he was seeing, "over their head as they stood with lowered wings. Above the vault over their heads was what looked like the throne, like a throne of lapis lazuli, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man." And so we see this sea of glass, this firmament, this vault, this crystalline sort of thing as the platform for the throne of God. And so we've got these things building on. Also, the laver, which was in the presence of the Lord in Solomon's temple. So when the offerings were to be brought forward, they were to be washed in the laver, which is like a big bath. But that laver was referred to as the sea. And so the laver in the presence of the Lord in Solomon's temple, we read in 1 Kings chapter 7, it says, "He made the sea of cast metal, circular in shape, measuring 10 cubits from rim to rim and 5 cubits high. It took a line of 30 cubits to measure around it." And so when it says that there was this, saw what looked like a sea of glass, we tend to think of ocean when we hear the word sea, but for the first century Christians, they would have been used to the phrase around the temple worship, where this sea, which was a big laver, a big bath in front of the temple, was called the sea. And we then go on in Exodus chapter 14, we see the Israelites standing on the edge of the Red Sea. And this time it is talking about an ocean. So the Red Sea, we read they're being pursued by the Egyptians. It says, "Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left." And so we've got this picture here of the saints of God standing on the side of the sea, and God's on the other side, and it's like this picture of the Israelites coming out of Egypt on the edge of the Red Sea. And this sea that's appearing in John's vision is a sea of glass mixed with fire, so it is red in colour. So we've got this picture going on as well. And also the image of the sea of blood throughout Israel presented at the end of chapter 14, which we were talking about last week. It says, "The angel swung his sickle on earth, gathered its grapes and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. And they were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horse's bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia. And so we've got this picture because it's only just occurred in the vision, but it's still fresh in the mind of the readers. So there's a heap going on here, just in that sort of little picture there. But the image, when you bring it all together, ties together the sense of there being a cleansing that's about to happen, and also deliverance for the saints in the laver of Christ's atonement, and the judgment of God on the covenant breakers. And so it's a very complex image drawing on Israel's history and practice. to present that idea to the first century Christians. And then it says they sang the song of Moses and of the Lamb. Now, the song of Moses is an interesting one that was given to the Israelites when they had been given the law. And at the end of explaining all of the law, Moses and Joshua taught the people a song. And it's quite a long one. I'm not going to read it all, but you might want to go there. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 32. And we'll just give you a little bit of time to find it. And so when it says this is the song of Moses and the Lamb, it would call to mind the fact that there's a song of Moses and Joshua. Now, we know that Joshua is, when you translate Joshua into Greek, the name is Jesus. So they both mean the Lord's, they both mean Savior. And so the idea of this being the song of Moses and of Jesus, the Lamb, kind of really ties it back to this one. And so it starts out by talking about how wonderful God is and how good he's been to the Israelites. And I'm going to pick it up in verse 10 of Deuteronomy 32. It says, in a desert land he found him, talking about Israel, in a barren and howling waste. He shielded him and cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spreads its wings to catch them and carries them aloft. The Lord alone led him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the heights of the land and fed him with the fruit of the fields. He nourished him with honey from the rock and with oil from the filthy, from the flinty crag. With curds and milk from herd and flock, and with fattened lambs and goats, with choice rams of Bashan and the finest kernels of wheat. You drank the foaming blood of the grape. Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. Filled with blood, they became heavy and sleek. And they abandoned the God who made them and rejected the rock, their Saviour. They made him jealous with their foreign gods and angered him with their detestable idols. They sacrificed to false gods, which are not God. Gods they had not known, gods that recently appeared, gods your ancestors did not fear. And you deserted the rock who fathered you. You forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw this and rejected them because he was angered by his sons and daughters. I will hide my face from them, he said, and see what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation, children who are unfaithful. They made me jealous by what is no God and angered me with their worthless idols. I made them envious by those who are not a people. I will make them angry by a nation that has no understanding. For a fire will be kindled by my wrath, one that burns down to the realm of the dead below and set afire the foundation of the mountains. So what we can see here is that God's saying, look, I gave you everything. I provided you with comfort and with riches, and you know, you were nothing, but I took you out and I led you to a place of rich blessing, but you just turned your back on me. And because you've turned your back on me and rejected my rock, then I'm going to bring punishment on you. And that punishment is a wrath mixed with fire. We go on to verse 39, because it's just kind of more of that sort of stuff. It says, see now that I myself am he. There is no God besides me. I put to death and I bring to life. I have wounded and I will heal, and no one can deliver out of my hand. I lift my hand to heaven and solemnly swear, as surely as I live forever, when I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand grasps it in judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries and repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood while my sword devours flesh. The blood of the slain and the captives, the heads of the enemy leaders, rejoice, you nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will take vengeance on his enemies and make atonement for his land and people. And so when we read the Song of Moses and the Lamb, it's kind of the Reader's Digest version of the more extended one that we read in Deuteronomy chapter 32. It starts out by saying, great and marvelous, which is the words that are used of the vision itself. You know, he saw a great and marvelous sign of the seven angels. And so great and marvelous are God's deeds. He moves in truth. He rules over the nations. And those who do not fear the name of the Lord, that is, trust in him alone for salvation and glorify him alone, all the nations, that is, the nations which goes beyond Israel, will rejoice in his judgments. And so we've got this thing saying, you've got to rejoice in God. Why wouldn't you fear him? Because if you don't, there's wrath coming your way. But he's made a way, and the nations rejoice in his judgments. And remember that his judgments are, I guess, judgments of blessing and favor on those who are faithful to him. But it's a judgment of wrath on those who reject him. So, verse 5, it says, after this I looked, and we're in Revelation 15 now, sorry. After this I looked, and I saw in heaven the temple, that is the tabernacle of the covenant law, and it was opened. Out of the temple came the seven angels with the seven plagues. They were dressed in clean, shining linen and wore golden sashes around their chests. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls filled with the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with the smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. So the seven angels with the seven plagues come from the tabernacle of the covenant law, or the tabernacle of the testimony. It's called that because inside the Ark of the Covenant were the stones on which the law or the covenant was written. And so the tabernacle of the testimony means that this is the place where, you know, God's very presence dwelt, and it's the place where the covenant was kept. And it's a testimony both of the old and the new covenant, both of which stand in judgment against Israel. The old covenant stands in judgment against first century Israel because they've been unfaithful to the covenant and broken it. And the new covenant stands in judgment against first century Israel because they're the ones who have rejected the Lord's Messiah, the one whom the new covenant is about. So they didn't want to enter into the new covenant under Christ. And so they stand under judgment as a result of that. So the seven angels dressed in the apparel of the Lord with the, you know, white clothes and golden sashes and so on, are given seven bowls or vials or chalices. It depends on who you're reading and sort of how they've translated that word. But those objects are filled with the fiery wrath of God. And Israel is about to drink the cup of God's wrath for her unfaithfulness to the covenant and for their rejection of the Lord's Messiah. In Matthew 27 and verse 24, we read that when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I'm innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." And so the people of Jerusalem and of Israel had actually asked for God to take vengeance on them for the blood of Christ, which is a frightful thing. David Chilton, one of the commentators on Revelation, says or writes, "Drinking blood is inescapable. Either the ministers of the new covenant will serve it to us in the Eucharist, or they will pour it out of their chalices upon our heads." Pretty sobering words. So in the temple, what would happen when an offering is being made? The order of proceedings was that the lamb was slaughtered, incense would be offered, trumpets were sounded, and then the drink offerings were poured out, and the blood of the sacrifice was sprinkled seven times on the veil of the temple. What we read in the Apocalypse is that the lamb is presented as slain, the incense of the prayers of the saints is offered up, interceding for vengeance on Jerusalem. And the trumpets sound, bringing judgment upon the land. And now we're up to the point where the libation or the sort of drink offering of God's wrath is about to be poured out. And so we're following that sort of practice. Phil Carrington, who's another commentator on Revelation, says that this blood, the blood that follows the pouring out of the drink offerings, instead of bringing reconciliation, brings rejection and vengeance. Instead of being sprinkled seven times towards the veil, is poured seven times on the land. Instead of the appearance of the high priest with the blood of reconciliation, we've seen seven angels with the blood of vengeance. And this is written about in Hebrews in chapter 10 and verse 26. It says, "For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified in God?" You see, what we've seen through the book of Revelation is God is slow in his judgments. His anger is kindled slowly, and destruction is coming. And at this point at chapter 15, we've still got warnings coming out saying, you know, this is what's about to happen to the unfaithful covenant breakers. So there's still time to escape in one sense, but the angels are about to pour out God's wrath on the city because of their rejection of Christ and rejection of his covenant. And as it says in Hebrews, if they've rejected Christ, then there's nothing left for them to come back to God's presence. There's only the promise of judgment. And, you know, those words became vividly true in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed, as we're going to see in the next chapter. So as in the dedication of both the temple of Moses and the temple of Solomon, the true temple now is filled with smoke as a sign of God's indwelling presence and as a fiery warning of his judgment against the covenant breakers. So we know that when the tabernacle was devoted to God, God's presence came down and it was filled with smoke and no one could enter in or stand. And when Solomon dedicated his temple, the same thing happened. Now we have this image again because the new covenant is being established and the temple in heaven is about to be opened up in one sense, because the temple on earth is going to be destroyed. And so on the day of Pentecost, going back, I guess, 30 years beforehand, we read, or 40 years rather, in Acts chapter 2 and verse 16, Peter gets up and says, "But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. In the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even on my male servants and female servants in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy." And we all like that bit because that's, you know, that's what we're about as a Pentecostal church. It's all about the outpouring of the Spirit. But as we read on, and it says, "And I will show wonders in the heaven above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the day of the Lord comes, the great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." And so we look, you know, the outpouring of the Spirit happened in the book of Acts. There was that sort of on the day of Pentecost, the Spirit was poured out, but the pouring out of the Spirit was also a promise that judgment was to come upon the city of Jerusalem, and that blood and fire and billows of smoke, that's destruction language, because the old covenant has to be removed if the new covenant is going to be fully established. And to remove the old covenant, there needs to be a closing of accounts. "But it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." So we read that no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues were completed. Now, Jay Bengel, who's another commentator, he says that when God pours out his fury, it is fit that even those who stand with him even those who stand well with him should withdraw for a little and should restrain their inquiring looks. All should stand back in profound reverence till by and by the sky become clear again. What it's saying is that, of course, if God's wrath is going to be poured out, no one's going to enter the temple. Why would you? It's sort of like, you know, if you're a student at school and one of your mates is in the principal's office, you're not going to go in there unless you have to, you know, because it's that sense that, there's a fear. But it should come to pass that all who call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Can we have the communion emblems handed out? I guess, you know, these are difficult chapters to read because it's dealing... Thanks very much, Casey. It's dealing with some pretty frightening events. But we need to understand that we don't get the full gospel unless we understand the fullness of the wrath of God. Because we were all once under his wrath. The scripture's pretty clear about that. That we were all covenant breakers. We were all unfaithful to God. That we all resisted him and rejected him. And that's, you know, we've got to realize that. Because if we don't realize that, we'll never really understand what we've been saved from. And we'll never appreciate what we've been saved to. Because just like the covenant-breaking Israelites, we've all transgressed the law of God. We've all broken his law. We've all gone after idols. We've rejected God as the supreme Lord of the universe, and we've gone after other things thinking that they were somehow able to deliver us and help us. And we've rejected his provision. And more than that, we've also rejected his Messiah, that we have all at some stage, you know, rejected Christ and lived as if his sacrifice does nothing for us. And so we all, that's our default position, that we all stand under God's condemnation because of our willful disobedience. It's, some people call it original sin. It's our nature. Sin is part of us, and our rebellion against God is part of who we are. Because Adam and Eve chose to rebel, and we are their descendants. But understanding that if we were in Adam and Eve's shoes, I don't think any of us could say that we would have done anything different. Because we all think we know what's best. We don't trust God. And that's at the heart of our rebellion and our sin. But Jesus came to bear the wrath that we deserve and drink the cup that we should have drunk so that we can enjoy the new wine of the new covenant. And it's not because of anything we've done, it's because of his work. And because he's done that, we then escape the wrath of God. Because Christ has borne it on our behalf. But if we reject Christ, then, you know, as it says in Hebrews, there's nothing left but the promise of wrath and of judgment. And, you know, maybe that's why we find these chapters so uncomfortable, is because our flesh still fears God in an unholy way. But our spirit fears God in a holy way. Because we're called to fear God, as it says in the Song of Moses and the Lamb, that who will not fear you? Everyone's going to fear God, or everyone does fear God. The question is, do we fear his wrath because we know that we're guilty? Or do we fear offending the one who has rescued us from his wrath and disappointing him, or, you know, not being all that he's purchased us to be? So there's two types of fear, but everyone's going to fear. We thank God that by his grace, he's revealed Christ to us by his Holy Spirit. And that so now the fear that we have is a holy and reverent fear. It's not a cowering fear like Adam and Eve who hid from God in the garden. But it's a fear that gives respect to God because we understand the power of his wrath and what it is to fear his presence, but in a good and holy way. And as David Chilton said, that we're all going to drink blood. That we either drink the blood of the new covenant, which is what we're about to do now, is to take communion and participate in the Lord's Supper. Because if we, by doing so, we participate in what he's done for us, and we confirm that we have been saved because we've called on his name. But for those who would reject his cup, they're going to be forced to drink the cup of God's wrath, which is a thing that I guess it's fearful and it's a horrific thing to ponder. Just trying to find that quote again. Here it is. Drinking blood is inescapable. Either the ministers of the new covenant will serve it to us in the Eucharist, or they will pour it out of their chalices upon our heads.